This sermon was delivered at Grand Avenue Baptist Church, a gospel-centered church in Ames, Iowa. Hear more sermons and learn more about Grand Avenue at gabcames.org.
All righty. You should have a handout. That'll be what you're going to need to follow along. We're going to be looking at the book of Esther this week. I'm excited about this, looking forward to this. I decided this might be helpful. I made a model handout, so there's some blanks that you'll need to fill out. If you miss one at the end, you can come up and look at this and just kind of fill in whatever you missed for those of you who are completers. Otherwise, yeah, just gotta try to follow along and catch the blanks as we move through. We're gonna be looking at Esther. This has been just sweet to get to study, sweet to get to prep for. So I've been looking forward to this throughout the week. Just getting to dig into it a little bit more in depth. Let me pray, and then we're just gonna jump into Esther and see what the Lord would have for us. Lord, thank you so much for your grace and your mercy. Thank you for your word and how it guides us and shapes us. Please help us today. Guide us by your hand. You are our shepherd. We trust you. You are our teacher. We listen to you. Help us to hear what you would have to say to us today. We love you, Lord Jesus. It's in your name we pray. Amen. Okay, so the book of Esther, it is a short little kind of novella in the middle of the Old Testament. It's a really interesting little book. It's just this tight little narrative. It's a unique book in a lot of ways, it's just interesting. Sometimes overlooked, sometimes it gets really emphasized, and I think it's going to be interesting to look into. So, what's up with Esther? So this kind of takes place during the exile in Babylon. So if you're familiar with kind of the general story of the Old Testament, right, the Israelites after the Exodus, they move into the Promised Land, and then through their disobedience, the Lord exiles them from the Promised Land into Babylon. And so kind of during that exile is when this story takes place. So they're originally carted off to Babylon by Babylon, but then Babylon gets conquered by the Persians, and so this is during the reign of the Persians. More or less, based on which king is ruling, we know it takes place roughly sometime between 486 BC and 464 BC. One of the later narratives in the Old Testament, there's not a lot that takes place after this. So it's kind of one of the later narratives that we see. It's much more of an intimate narrative. It affects the whole nation, right? It has really wide-reaching implications as a story, but really it's about kind of four key characters. It's this court drama of the king, and it's a really intimate kind of narrative. And what's really interesting, and we'll kind of touch on this a little bit, it's the one book in the Bible that never mentions God. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? We'll kind of see what's going on there and why that might be, and kind of just some things we can learn from that. But it's a really interesting narrative choice that the author uses as he structures this story. Okay, so what are our key themes? The big ones are this: God's sovereignty over his people and individual lives. It's not just this kind of overarching sovereignty over the nation, but it involves the individual. Second theme is responsibility and duty. And then third, the difficulty and need to trust God. So let's dig into the characters. There's, like I said, kind of four major characters. The first one I'll mention is a guy named Mordecai. That's just a sweet name. That's one of those Bible names that needs to make a comeback. There's reasons why it doesn't. Too many scary movies. But anyways, so he's a descendant of King Saul, which is interesting. We learn that in chapter 2, verse 5, or at least one of Saul's brothers. Interestingly, it mentions that he's a descendant of kind of one guy, another guy, and then also Kish of the tribe of Benjamin. And reading through that, you might not catch exactly what that's talking about, but Kish is Saul's dad, right? And so he's probably a descendant of Saul, but at least, you know, one of Saul's brothers, right? So he's kind of from that line. And there's a reason that he does that. The author really is very subtle and very underplayed. He doesn't come out and say, hey, this is Mordecai, he's a descendant of Saul. He doesn't even mention Saul, but it's very important that he mentions Kish, right? That he mentions this lineage. He's very subtle with the way that he's telling this story. So one common kind of thread through Esther is kind of how often the writer almost says things. How often he almost says things, right? So there's kind of the big climax where Mordecai is telling Esther, you know, basically like, you're in the right time and place for this. Who knows whether, you know, this is the time that you were brought here for. He's very much talking about God's sovereignty, God's purposes, what God's going to do to save his people. Never mentions God. It's always in the passive. It's always in, you know, who, like, somehow the people are going to be saved, and who knows whether you've been put here. Put here by who, right? Never quite says what he's trying to say. Same with giving Mordecai's genealogy and his lineage. See within some of the other characters as well. Next is Haman. Haman, he's an Agagite. We learn that in chapter 3, verse 1. And this is why it's important that he mentions the lineage, the connection with Saul. Does anybody know who Agag is? Who's Agag? Creepy guy with bad teeth.
The king
that Saul did kill. Yes. Yeah, so Agag is the king of the Amalekites who Saul was told by God to kill, to exterminate the people and to eliminate this king Agag, and Saul decides not to. He has a better plan than God, and it's for not killing Agag that God takes the kingdom away from Saul. And so right off the bat, so kind of the major tension in this story is the conflict between Mordecai and Haman here. And so what the author is again just hinting at, just very subtly kind of putting on the table, but not really putting a neon sign next to, is, hey, this is an echo of this ongoing conflict that goes all the way back to Saul and Agag, and even before. Then we get Esther, who the book is named after. She is Mordecai's cousin, but raised by Mordecai because her parents died when she was young. And also, it's worth noting, she is exceptionally beautiful. That's kind of, we'll see throughout the rest of the story why that's relevant. And then we get to the king, Ahasuerus. I have no idea how to pronounce that. Ahasuerus, something like that. I'm going to call him the king, but there's his name right there. So he's the king of Persia, right? He's Persian, and so he's the king. He's king in all this land, in this huge land, right? He's not kind of some small king. He's like, historically, Alexander the Great is kind of one of his peers, right? Like, this is the level of just like global influence that this guy has. And so there's a really interesting, one of the things that just really stood out to me as kind of working through this book this time around is just the really kind of significant leadership lessons that can be learned from the king's role in this book. In what's going on here. All right, so he's a huge king. He's huge, like, widely influential. I think it describes his kingdom as from basically like India to Ethiopia, right? So this is just a huge portion of the world that he's ruling over. And it's surprising how much of this story kind of hinges on him taking responsibility to do his job. Kind of when this king is being kind of just an entitled frat boy, right? Just throwing parties and getting drunk. Things are going poorly and wicked people are just kind of having their way and doing their own thing in his kingdom. But as soon as the story turns, the moment the story turns is when the king wakes up and starts to take responsibility and be the king and actually start to prosecute justice in his kingdom. So it's really interesting. He's one of the more, the most color we get in this story is of the king, kind of what's going on in his mind. What's he thinking about? What's he doing? And so it's just fascinating to kind of trace through what this book is saying about the king and what he's doing and how he's living. It's interesting. He starts out the story, he's throwing this huge, like 180-day, like 6-month party just to show off his glory, right? The story starts with his pride, his vanity, his drunkenness, and just his wicked dishonoring of his wife is kind of how this story gets kicked off. And then the conflict, if you're familiar with the story, we'll get into the story a little bit more in a little bit here, but when it really, the ball kind of gets rolling, basically this Haman guy kind of comes to the king and says, hey, there's this people that you'd probably be better off if we just exterminated. The king doesn't even ask which people. He doesn't even ask, like, for any kind of evidence or any kind of verification. He's just kind of like, yeah, sure, go for it. If you say so, like, well, you know, why not? He's not even doing his due diligence to even kind of ask, like, what people are you even talking about? He's just not doing his due diligence as a king. It's interesting. We see specifically that he and Haman get together for some drinks while the city descends into chaos because of this edict that he just kind of unawarely signs and sets into motion. In chapter 3, verse 15, we see the couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree, this we'll talk about kind of what that was later, was issued in Susa, the citadel, kind of the capital city. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. So one of the threads that's getting tugged on in this story is what happens when kings don't do their job. When leaders don't do their job, it's chaos for the people, and wicked people prosper. Proverbs 31, verses 4 through 9 touches on this. I think it'd be interesting to kind of tease out the kind of specific proverbs that might be relevant to the story of the king in Esther, but one of them here is this. Proverbs 31, 4 through 9 says, "It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to take strong drink, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted." Right, so again, throughout the story, one of the more common themes is, and the king and Haman, they sat down to have some drinks. And the king and Haman, they sat down to have some drinks. So this king, instead of ruling, he's given himself over to wine. Then the proverb goes on and says, "Open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. Open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy." That's the arc of Esther. The king is giving himself to wine, and the rights of the poor and the needy are being trampled on and being oppressed, and people and the whole nation of Israel is being threatened with extermination. But then all of a sudden he turns and he opens his mouth for the destitute, and he just kind of lifts his hand, and the problem is solved. So, anyways, it's interesting the sway and the significance of this king in this story. Okay, so what is the story? Starts out. Basically, the ball gets rolling when, again, the king is throwing this big party to his own glory, and he calls his wife and says, "Hey, I want you to show all the governors how beautiful my wife is. So go and present yourself and show off your beauty." And she doesn't want to do that. She refuses to do that. And so he sends her away. He divorces her because she won't do that for him. And again, there's another interesting just segment of how he's listening to the counsel of these wicked men who are pressuring him to do that. So then he basically puts on this like beauty pageant to choose a new wife, right? And so every governor kind of sends the most beautiful women they can find to go and you know, come to the capital and contest for the right to be this guy's wife. And at the end of it, Esther ends up winning, you know, and that's, you know, not exactly how it reads in the story, but she's selected as his next wife. And what's interesting is that Mordecai, her cousin, her what's the term? Basically, adopted father, tells her not to reveal the fact that she's a Jew. Doesn't spell out exactly why. Basically, just kind of tells her like, "Hey, don't tell him. Don't let him know." That becomes relevant as the story unfolds. And then, so that happens, she gets selected, and then there's kind of this pause where we then see this conflict between Mordecai and Haman. Basically, Haman is kind of this rising star in the empire. He's this key official for the king, and he kind of likes to go around town and make you know, his criers go out in front of him and tell everybody to bow to him and to pay homage to Haman, and Mordecai just won't. He just kind of refuses to bow to this man. He wouldn't bow to honor him. And it specifically says that he, again, this is one of those interesting places where it almost mentions God. Let's see. Where does that go? Anyway, basically, it says that he wouldn't bow because he is a Jew. Right, and so you kind of, again, hinted at this idea of like what it means to be a Jew is to be someone who worships the true and living God. And so, because of that, he's not going to bow to Haman, right? So again, doesn't mention God, but mentions the people of God as the reason why he won't break the first and second commandments. Anyway, so that irritates Haman, and he decides, "I'm not just going to get vengeance on Mordecai. I'm going to try to exterminate his entire people." Goes to the king and says, "Hey, these people, they're bad news. They don't obey the king's laws. We should exterminate them." Again, the king doesn't even ask which people. He just kind of says, "Go for it, man. You're my buddy. I trust you. Go ahead and do that." All right, probably still kind of got bloodshot eyes from the night before. Anyway, so he goes and gets that rolling, and the king stamps that into law, that they're gonna set this date to exterminate the Jewish people from within the empire. And then Mordecai hears about it. Another interesting kind of note that's relevant in there is, I think right after Esther is selected as queen, Mordecai saves the king's life. He just kind of hears about this assassination plot and lets the king know. So the king is saved, but he doesn't do anything to honor Mordecai. Again, he's not really doing his job. He's not really paying attention. He just kind of, says a little thank you and moves on. But they write it down. They do the scribes at least do the due diligence, and they kind of write that down. So Mordecai has this plan, and he basically tells Esther, like, hey, your husband is going to exterminate us. You need to go and talk to him, try to get him to change his mind. And this is how you're gonna save the people. And so interestingly, she has some hesitations about that, which is kind of hard for us to kind of quite wrap our minds around. But remember how the story started? Not exactly, a model husband here, right? And so there's some trepidation just about his character and how he treats his wives in general. And so she has some fears because it's illegal, basically, to approach the king uninvited. If you approach the king and he basically says, hey, you're wasting my time, you shouldn't have approached me, the penalty is death. Right, so if you're going to approach the king, you better be confident that he's going to be interested in what you have to say. Does that make sense? So it's a big deal to just kind of like, you don't just walk into the king and say, hey, I have some thoughts I'd like to run by you. Right, that might end very poorly for you. So she has some understandable fears. If I go and he's just like doesn't want to hear it, maybe doesn't want to see me, and she even notes that he hasn't summoned her, he hasn't bothered to even check in with his wife in the last 30 days. And so she's thinking, I don't even know if this guy likes me. I don't know if he's going to be interested in this. I don't know if he's going to care. Like, if he's busy or bored or irritated, I just might be the next former wife of the king. And might not even have the dignity of getting dismissed. So she has some understandable fears. But Mordecai says this. I'll just read this section. It's a couple verses in chapter 4. This is what gets stitched on pillows and all the rest. He says, and they told Mordecai what Esther had said. So all this is happening like via text message, right? They're kind of sending their messengers back and forth. So they told Mordecai what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than the other Jews, right? So basically you're in danger too. For if you keep silent at this time, this is really interesting. Notice his conviction. If you keep silent at this time, he doesn't say that'll be bad news for our people. He says, if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. So clearly Mordecai is operating with an understanding that there is a hand behind history, moving the pieces on the chessboard. Somehow deliverance is going to come, but you and your father's house will perish, right? So there's a certain sense of Mordecai saying, you have an obligation here, and if you don't do your duty, God's going to save his people, but it might go poorly for you. And who knows? This is, again, pointing to God's providence. Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this, right? Basically saying, like, this might be the very reason that God was moving all of these pieces around the chessboard to get you into the right place at just the right time. Never mentions that it was his quabble that started the problem in the first place, but that's neither here nor there. So he gives her this plea, and then she says, okay, that's great, let's do it. And so she decides to do it, try to save the people. And she then responds in faith, and she asks, basically says, set up a fast, tell all the people to fast for 3 days on my behalf. Again, doesn't even mention prayer, but if you're talking about fasting, you're implying prayer. If you're talking about fasting, you're talking about imploring God to move, right? So it's, again, he almost mentions God. It's so interesting how, he teases these kind of behind-the-scenes things that are going on. Let's see. Interesting, just kind of messianic echo here, right? So Esther fasted for 3 days, right? Fasting is this symbol of a kind of letting go of life and pleasure to ask for divine help. Then risked death, right? Went to the place where she goes into this court, she might not come back out. Risked death to intercede before the throne for her people, before the judgment seat, resulting in their salvation, passing from the threat of death to life. Right, so think about how that kind of echoes what Jesus does. Then Jesus, the bigger and better Esther, she fasted for 3 days. He was in the grave for 3 days. She risked death for his people, for her people. He was killed for his people. She interceded before the king of Persia. He intercedes now before the king of the cosmos. She saved the Jews from the threat of death. He saved the church from actual death. She gave them life to live for a few more decades. He gives us eternal life. Right, again, this is an echo. For those who have eyes to see the echoes and the hints and the whispers of Jesus all through the Old Testament. So back to the story. Then she says, I'm going to do this. She has the fast, and then she goes before the throne. This is really interesting. She goes into the court, and basically the idea is, like, if he extends his kind of golden scepter to her, then she can, you know, she can say what she has to say, and he's not going to kill her. So, you know, nice guy. Decides not to kill his wife. So he does that. He says, hey, babe, I'm not going to kill you today. Come on in. Good guy. Really see him turning around. And what's interesting is she doesn't just kind of like out and out ask right away. She's not like, all right, here's this thing. By the way, I'm a Jew, and that whole plan that Haman told you about, that's going to exterminate me and my people. I have this, you know, could you not? She doesn't say that. She basically says like, hey, how about dinner? Bring Haman. And so she invites him to a banquet. I think that night, maybe the next night. Asks him to a banquet, and he says, all right, sounds good. So what's interesting, there's something in Hebrew literature that we see a lot, basically what's called a delayed climax, where the kind of the narrative pressure is building towards, all right, it's coming, right? She's fasting, she's going to go into the throne room to ask her big question, and it's like, dinner? That wasn't exactly what I thought she was going to ask him about. Okay, so we see this... This happens with Job. Like this happens in Job too. You see kind of the friends in Job are kind of bickering back and forth, and you expect, all right, God's going to have his say now. Then all of a sudden this random guy, Elihu, comes in, and he talks for like 6 chapters. And then God talks, right? I think this is what's happening with the Garden of Gethsemane. I think this is something where you see the big climax is coming up, and then all of a sudden there's this pause, a very intimate look at what Jesus is doing in that moment. You see this, there's lots of different things that happens that can be done with those moments, but it just builds up the pressure for the then coming climax of the story. Helps to kind of focus in on what's about to happen. Often the narrative slows way down, and it just gets a lot more intimate. So they come to the feast, they have this feast, again, they're drinking, and the king says, all right, Esther, what I know this wasn't what you were, you risked your life to have a meal with me and my buddy, so what is it you wanted to ask? And she says, all right, here's what I want you to do. Come to dinner tomorrow night. Bring Haman. And she has another banquet. She throws another banquet for them and asks them to come back. And she says, like, all right, at that banquet, I'm gonna ask you, but just come back again another night. And so this is really interesting. This second day, right, between the first banquet to the second, creates this space for the story to turn, which is really, really interesting. So we see after the first banquet, Haman goes out, he's having a good time, and he goes home and he's talking to his buddies about how amazing he is and how awesome he is, and they're talking to him about how amazing he is and how awesome he is. And he says, what should I do with this Mordecai guy? What's up with this Mordecai? What should I do? And again, he's probably kind of got the wine glow going on. They're like, what you need to do is set up a really big stake outside to nail him to. And just execute them in front of your house. Interesting little gardening decoration choices. But so he sets up this big execution stake to hang him on. The ESV calls it a gallows. Basically, yeah, where you would execute somebody. Puts it in front of his house. And then he goes to bed. And then that night, here's where I think the story turns. Here's, I think, where the story turns is chapter 6, verse 1. It says, on that night, the king could not sleep. So this is after the first banquet, before the second banquet. It says, on that night, the king could not sleep. There's a lot going on there. I think sometimes the Lord will just do that. You got stuff on your mind, and you just can't sleep, and the Lord just has business to do with you. You need to think about something. You need to be praying for something. You need to figure something out. You need to make a decision, and the Lord just won't let you sleep. Or often, and it might be a little bit of both for the king, often there's a place where when you're just not living in what you should be doing, you're resting, but you're never rested. It's a restless kind of apathy that you're living in, where you know there's work you're supposed to be doing, there's influence you're supposed to be exerting, there's tasks you're supposed to be giving yourself over to. But then when you maybe it's booze and food and laziness like the king here, or maybe it's whatever else. There's just this sense of I'm choosing a life of rest, but I'm not finding any rest because I'm not living in the way and the life that God has told me to do. And so there's just this sleep with no sleep, rest with no rest. And so you get into this moment where you get that experience, right? You're up in the middle of the night. It's 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m. Everybody else in the house is asleep. Everybody else feels like everybody else in the town is asleep. And it's just kind of you and God. And there's something that the Lord wants to do with you in that moment. This is what's going on with the king. And so it says, he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. Why did he want to read these chronicles, these events? It doesn't really get teased out. Well, what's he thinking about of something that he missed, something that he didn't fulfill? He's probably thinking, I haven't been executing justice. I need to see the records. What am I missing here? Because he specifically gets, it was found written how Mordecai told about the assassination plot who were guarding the king. And the king said, what honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? He's asking, that guy saved my life. Justice demands that he be rewarded. What did I do for him? And they said to him, nothing has been done for him. Nothing has been done for him. And so he's starting to wake up to realize that in his kingdom, justice is not being carried out. So he says, who's in the court? Who's here? And just so happens, again, that Haman had walked in to the king's palace to talk to the king. You just had something to talk to him about. So Haman walks in, and this is great. He basically asks the king, then the king, speaking first because he's the king, says, all right, Haman, got a question for you. Hypothetically, if I really wanted to honor somebody, what should I do for him? And Haman even says, Haman basically thinking like, who else would he want to honor but me? Who could he possibly have in mind to honor but number one, Haman? And so he gives him this whole idea, like what you should do, put your robe on him, put your ring on him, give him your best horse, and have one of your key nobles lead him through the street saying, this is what the king will do to those who he decides to honor. And the king's like, that's a great idea. Find Mordecai. Do you know who Mordecai is? Have you ever heard of Mordecai? Find Mordecai. Do that. Lead him through the streets telling people how much I honor Mordecai. And Haman's kind of just like, oh no, that's kind of a bummer. And so this is where a story starts to turn. All of a sudden the king wakes up, and the wicked start to get put down, and the righteous start to get lifted up. The king is awake now, and justice is starting to be done. So they do that. Mordecai gets a new robe, goes for a little test drive, and they come back to the second banquet. And king asks, Esther, what do you want me to do for you? What's going on? And she. And so remember, just all that just fell into place. All of a sudden, the king understands this Mordecai guy, a Jew, is the reason I'm still alive today. I owe my life to this Mordecai. And so Esther tells him, here's what's happening. She says, let's see. We have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed and to be killed and to be annihilated. If we've been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I have been silent for afflictions, not to be compared to the loss to the king. Then the king says to Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who has dared to do this? And Esther said, a foe and enemy, this wicked Haman. And this, I think, is really interesting. So throughout the story, Esther has mostly been called Esther. Mostly been called Esther. As we've gotten closer to this moment, she starts to get called Queen Esther. And the king starts calling her Queen Esther. She's starting to step out of just kind of little old Esther and into actually have an influence, a role, a duty and a role of influence to exert for the good of my people. And she starts to get called Queen Esther. She's stepping into her duty. She's stepping into her responsibility. And I love this. The last part of this, verse 6. Then Haman was terrified before who? Before the king and the queen. Doesn't say King so-and-so, doesn't say Queen Esther, just the king. All of a sudden, it's not whatever his name is, it's the king is there. And the queen, as the queen, is there. And the wicked man is terrified. All of a sudden, he's terrified because the king is being the king and the queen is being the queen. This is so consistent throughout the scriptures, is that so much of our problems, so much of the chaos in our world and our families and our lives comes when we just won't be what God has made us to be. When dad won't be dad, the family deteriorates. When the boss won't be the boss, but kind of just lets the employees kind of duke it out among themselves to figure out who gets the best clients, things go terrible. When those who have responsibility don't live in their responsibility that God has given them, it goes chaotic real quick. But the picture here is that when the king wakes up and starts to be the queen, it starts to be the king, and when the queen finally has faith to step into her role and stop being some kind of provincial lady who has no responsibility in the kingdom, starts to recognize the fate of my people hangs on my shoulders. I need to step forward in faith. She even has a line, if I perish, I perish. She says, I'm going to do my duty. Whatever God would have come to pass, I'm going to do my duty. That is when the people get saved and the wicked men start to get terrified. So then we get to resolution. The king, then he all of a sudden he sees not only, so this Haman, he's plotting this plan to exterminate this people that would include Mordecai, the guy who saved me, and my wife. This is a bad day for Haman. It's a real bad day for Haman. So he takes Haman back to his house and hangs him on the gallows that Haman built for Mordecai. Right? Haman is hanged. The Jews are spared. There's a feast established, and Mordecai is honored. So what's going on here? Theology, God's providence is kind of the big theme underneath all of this. The theme of the book is God's sovereign work in preserving the Jewish people from annihilation. God is sovereign over sin to bring about his purposes. We see this whole story gets kicked off. Esther gets put in place because of the king's sin. There's just no way around that. God is sovereign over the king's sin to bring about salvation for his people. God is sovereign over random events to bring about his purposes. Just so happens that Haman walked in at just the right time. Just so happens that Mordecai was in the right place at the right time to hear about this plot. And God is sovereign over simple acts of faith to bring about his purposes. Acts of faith. We see this in Esther particularly. And yeah, I love that Mordecai, what he was doing was he was speaking faith to her. He's saying, God is going to save our people. Through you or through somebody else. So would you act in faith? Then redemption, we see the conflict between the serpent and the woman. We see this going back to Genesis 3, verse 15. Now I'll put enmity between you, the serpent, and the woman. We see God's faithfulness to the Abrahamic promise. Abrahamic promise, Genesis 12, 3. Those who curse you, I will curse. Haman set himself up for destruction as soon as he set his mind to destroy the Jews. As soon as he decided to oppose and destroy the Jews, he set himself up for God's curse and destruction. So application. Again, this is just another example of look back, look forward. Remember God's subtle providence in fulfilling his purposes. I think this is why the author never quite doesn't hit you over the head with what's going on in this story. Right? So much of this story is God's subtle providence. You wouldn't even notice it as God's providence until you look back on the story being told. The same thing is how we should look at the events of our lives. The same sovereign hand governing events in Esther is governing your life today. And God's hand is hard to see in the middle of the course of events. It's just hard to see. What is God moving things in a special way and what isn't? It's just hard to see. But for the Christian, we know that he is doing it, that he is governing things, whether you can see it or not. Then last, our duty to act in trust. Mordecai is the guy who says this, who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? All right, pop quiz for a lot of bonus points. Here's this quote, so do I. And so do all who live to see such times. But that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us. Who said that? Excellent. To who? When? No. Yes. Yeah, so they're kind of looking at Gollum, what he's doing. Lots of bonus points to Josh. Gabe, you get half credit, Gabe. Yeah, I just love that. I love that moment, right? All we have to do is decide what to do with the time that's given us. Esther didn't ask to be in that situation. Esther didn't try to be in that situation. She just was in that situation. And so being there, the decision was hers. What are you going to do with the opportunity that's given you? Are you going to be faithful to the opportunity that's been put in front of you, or are you going to hide? Are you going to shrink back? Also, I think the overarching theme of Lord of the Rings is God's providence. But anyway, so it's a conversation for another day. God's providential control is an invitation to us to act boldly. That's the next blank. In faith, not an excuse to sit back and do nothing. I think that's a common problem that we get into when we start to think about God's providence, is that it leads us towards this like, oh, well, God's in control. I'm just not going to do anything. He'll work it out. But we should think like Mordecai. God is in control of events. He is going to bring about his good purposes. It's going to be through somebody. Why not through you? Act. Do the scary thing. God's going to save. God's going to work. God's going to act. It might as well be through you. Step out boldly in faith. God's providence should give us courage to act boldly. The next blank is responsibility. Okay, so we'll wrap it up there.